Since the dawn of civilization, spies of every nation and culture have worked to infiltrate their adversaries and glean the information that will give their side the advantage. The stakes are sky high, the strategies varied and imaginative, and the ultimate sign of success is that no one ever even knew you were there. In each episode, we will explore the moral and ethical gray zones of espionage, where treachery and betrayal go hand in hand with cunning and courage. This is the Spycraft 101 podcast. Welcome to your clandestine classroom. This is episode number 143 of the Spycraft 101 podcast. My guest today is Nick Vanderbilt. Nick served for 24 years as a regular in the British Army in military intelligence, security, and later as an infantry officer in the Territorial Army. He saw active service in Northern Ireland, Belize, and with the 3 Commando Brigade during the Falklands conflict. Since leaving the service, Nick has published 23 books on military history, covering several different conflicts and eras. I invited Nick onto the podcast to discuss his new book, My Friends, the Enemy. It's the story of his experiences during the Falklands War between Argentina and the United Kingdom, which lasted for 74 days beginning in April 1982. Nick was on the ground as a non-commissioned officer in the intelligence section of the 3rd Commando Brigade as British forces fought to retake the islands and worked to build the intelligence picture for commanders making life and death decisions every day. If you're looking for a way to get friends and family as interested in history as you are, or if you want to learn something new and unexpected every month, then make sure to check out History by Mail. Every month, History by Mail will send you reproductions of famous and influential historical documents from American history. Accompanying the documents themselves are articles which put them in the context of their times and help you understand the impact they had on the course of American life. The topics are widely varied, so you're always learning something new across themes that include historical inventions, American wars, and foreign diplomatic relations. I'm really enjoying my own subscription because it's opening my eyes to historic events I knew nothing about. For instance, one of the first packages I received contained a reproduction letter from Annie Oakley to President William McKinley, offering her services as a sharpshooter during the Spanish-American War of 1898. Who knew? Not me. You can subscribe for yourself or gift a subscription at historybymail.com for as little as $6.50 a month. Just click the link in the show notes of this episode and use the discount code Justin10 for a permanent 10% off your subscription. Nick, thank you for taking the time to speak to me today.
That's my pleasure.
I'm glad to hear it. I think this might be the first time in over 140 episodes that we've discussed intelligence work during large-scale combat operations. So this is a unique opportunity for me, and I didn't want to miss it.
Well, I'm delighted to be able to just point a little bit of what goes on in military intelligence. Some of it is obviously very secret. People will know. Some of it will see going on in any event. But I'm glad I've been able to at least point a little bit of what went on during the Falklands campaign.
Okay, fantastic. I'm sure people are excited to hear this, I promise.
Good, I'm delighted.
So can you start by telling us what made you decide to make this the subject of your book? Because as I said, you've written, I think, 23 now total.
Yes, I felt it was a story that needed to be told. A, because I had a first-hand experience and I felt could tell a good story. The Falklands is one of those campaigns which has affected Great Britain, not markedly by any means, but the mere fact that it was able to send a small task force 8,000 miles down to the South Atlantic to go and deal with a country or recover from a country about UK virtually knew nothing except it had a very good football team.
Yeah, that was one of the surprises. One of the things that was surprising to me is how much work had to happen so quickly for your section, which I think we'll get into in a few minutes here. But I mean, in the end, it worked out well, but I'm sure that you felt like you had your work cut out for you in the very first opening hours and days.
Oh, without a doubt. I mean, I remember the day very well. I'd just been for a run. We had arrived back at the brigade HQ in the barracks in Plymouth. And I hadn't even changed, frankly, when my boss said to me, oh, would you come up to the office there? And he explained that Argentina had taken over the Falkland Islands. The issue for the Royal Marines was that they had a small garrison down there who conceivably now had been taken prisoner. And the British, frankly, in any country, indeed, don't really like it when another country takes over another country for no good reason. Argentina will say that they believe they had and we'll come on to that a little bit later on, they believe that they were able to do such a thing. But I think the British would say, well, probably not today.
That's certainly what happened in the end, as we now know.
Absolutely.
So can you just tell us, prior to, like, the day before the conflict began, what was your position? What were your daily duties, that sort of thing, as a soldier or as a non-commissioned officer in military intelligence?
I was a staff sergeant. I guess in U.S. terms, it's one down from a sergeant major. I was the only intelligence corps in the 3rd Commando Brigade. British were very much involved in Northern Ireland, and their priority was Northern Ireland to virtually anything else. I had been in Hong Kong about 2 years before, and at the end of that tour, I then spent about 6 weeks on a jungle warfare course in Brunei, because I knew that I was going to go. I knew I was going to go to another place. When I was asked if I would fill a hole or fill a gap in the 3rd Commando Brigade, I jumped at it, frankly. I had always wanted to join the Commando Brigade from very early on, when I joined the Intelligence Corps. And here the opportunity came. But I did say to them that I wasn't prepared to do the Commando course because I felt I was sufficiently trained with the on the jungle warfare course and indeed other activities. And I had my own green beret. The Intelligence Corps wears a Cyprus green beret, which is very distinctive. And it became, we have our own cap badge. And as a consequence of that, I was asked, as I say, and then I then found myself in Plymouth.
Okay, I see. Was there any expectation on your part or anyone else's that this could happen before it did happen? Like, what was the relationship between Argentina and United Kingdom right up and before this occurred?
I wasn't aware of any great problem with Argentina. I knew Argentina had, like lots of parts of South America at that time, had their own issues, political issues and other issues. But I certainly wasn't aware that there was any idea that they would invade the Falkland Islands, although I was aware by their history and indeed our own history, that was always going to be that possibility. We talked earlier on, I'd been to Guatemala. Well, I'd been into Belize, in fact, the intelligence role there. So I was very much aware of the thoughts, if that's the right word, of the South Americans towards the British. And to some extent, the South Americans, they didn't really like people like the British and one or two others being in their own backyard. Although the countries themselves, as we found in both occasions, were very happy to have support from the British.
Hmm. Okay, I see. And what was it about the Falklands that made them so desirable that they were willing to try to take them by force? Is it resource rich, or is it a strategic location for shipping, or something like that, or just a historical claim maybe?
It basically is a historical claim going back to about 1493, 1494, when a Spanish pope issued a papal bull that the papacy was going to cut the world in half, one side for the Spanish and the other half to the Portuguese. Spain and indeed Portugal were very much dividing the North world into both their countries. The British and indeed the Dutch, who to some extent were Protestant, but certainly had no support to the Spanish or indeed to the Portuguese, objected to the treaty and ignored it. So it's largely a historical thing that filtered not only at the parts of South America. The British, 100 years later, thereabouts, sent their first little reconnaissance, if that's the right word, when an English navigator named John Davis was the first person to sight the Falkland Islands, or at least from Europe anyway. This was followed by a Dutchman 8 years later. And then again, about 100 years after that, an English captain, Captain John Strong, made a landing in the Falkland Islands, what we now know as the Falkland Sound, which is the sound between the two main islands. And he named it after Viscount Falklands, who was an admiralty official at the time. There was no great reaction from the French or indeed the Spanish, bearing in mind at that time in Europe, there was a lot of warfare going on between the various nations fighting amongst themselves. Oh, about 100 years later, after Captain Strong landed, a French navigator landed, on East Falklands, And it was at that occasion, it was around about this time, because the man came from St. Malo, that the Falkland Islands were known as Maloin, or indeed Las Malvinas. That's the Spanish from the French port of St. Malo. About a year later, after the French navigator landed, the British settlement was ejected by the Spanish in 1765, but it left a small outpost on West Falklands. For various reasons, mainly because of the Napoleonic Wars that were going on in Europe at that time, the Spanish maintained on the settlement until about 1816, when the new Spanish colony of Buenos Aires declared independence from Spain and proclaimed the sovereignty over the Falkland Islands. So you can see from what I've just been describing, it is all rather quite complicated.
Yeah, absolutely.
But was very typical, to be very honest about it, in that part of the world, at that time of the world, as you will know. Indeed, in 1831, the US became involved for the first time when the US warship, the Lexington, destroyed the Argentine settlement on the East Falklands and arrested them three whalers who were hunting seals at the time. And 2 years later, the British arrived and expelled the remaining officials, major Argentine officials, should I say, on the island. And from then, it became a British colony.
Okay, I had no idea they were contested so heavily through history.
You'd be quite surprised if you look at, dare I say, our history, or indeed world history, you'll find all sorts of weird and wonderful things going on, which even harker on today, all down to history in one way or the other.
Mm-hmm. Totally agree.
Yeah. So far as the British were concerned, they then sent up a governor, 1841 or thereabouts. But all the time, there was the Argentines pestering the British presence. In 1964, the UN debated the sovereignty for the Falklands for the first time for any great length of time. And whilst the Spanish or the Argentine proclaimed its claim on the papal bulls that I mentioned earlier on, the fact that the British on its claim was, as it says, I read, it says, open, continuous, effective possession, occupation, administration, the will of the UN sided on the side of the British, and indeed, half the reason, another good reason, was because the Falkland Islands themselves wanted self-determination as recognised by the United Nations, and that would be with the British, not Argentina. The UN approved the assembly, and for the next 20-odd years or so, Argentina continued to declare that the Falklands was Argentinian. And that basically is a little bit of history leading up to 1982, rather. Not very complicated what goes on, but that's basically what it's all about.
Yeah, there's very, very long-lasting ties there clearly between both countries. So in 1982, as a protectorate, what kind of military forces did the British government have in place in the islands?
It's the Royal Marines, who provided a small company. A British company is about, let's say, 70 blokes, and they rotated about every 6 months or so, and they were the garrison.
So around 70 personnel, 70 troops?
70 soldiers, yes, or Royal Marines, should I say. Everybody will acknowledge it was probably a rather weak force, but nevertheless, it was seen to be a presence, and the Marines, Royal Marines, changed every 6 months or so. The Falkland Islands themselves were delighted to see the British, the Royal Marines, and indeed any times when the Royal Navy turned up in their warships in the South Atlantic to call in to Stanley.
Mm-hmm. I see. So on the islands by that time, was it primarily everyone there was a British citizen, right?
Yes. But
was there like a mix of Argentinian culture or language? Were people bilingual, anything like that? Or was it pretty much just British influence at that point?
It was a British colony, and there was no desire from the Falkland Islands themselves that it would have anything to do with Argentina. Hmm. There was no doubt that there were one or two Argentines there. I don't know what they were up to, but we can only guess. But they were accepted as the people of the Falkland Islands, mm-hmm. essentially.
Okay, I see. So when this began, can you talk a little bit about how it was taken over? I mean, clearly, like you said, with just a single company there in the islands, there was not going to be a huge amount of fighting to begin with, I guess. How quickly were these Argentinian forces actually able to like fully occupy the islands?
As you so rightly say, they landed, my recollection was, a couple of regiments. Bear in mind that they were conscripts, inexperienced conscripts. But nevertheless, as Argentines, they firmly believed in Las Malvinas, it's the Falkland Islands, and they were more than happy. Certainly is my experience there. They were doing a job which was something that the country wanted them to do, and they believed it was right and just to do. It wasn't a very big organization, 70-odd men or 70-odd commandos, Royal Marines, should I say. They did the right thing, which was to resist. But they knew that there were no Royal Navy, there was no Air Force. They were 8,000 miles away from UK. The nearest people were people who might be sympathetic. Might have been the South Africans, but not really.
Mm.
The nearest British base was Ascension Island, about 4,000 miles to the south. So it was a dead loss, really. There was nothing they could do. They did the right thing in many respects, which was to leave the island.
Hmm. I see. Yeah, they were caught in an impossible situation, no question, because as we clearly can see, it was, you know, true support was weeks away, because that's how long it took you to, you know, fully mobilize the forces that did eventually arrive. I'm curious, Nick, were there any signs, like in hindsight, was there anything that the Foreign Office missed about the buildup for and the preparations for this, or anything that the MOD missed that perhaps could have given a little bit of advance warning?
Not as far as I'm aware, not that I've heard of. And certainly when I got to Stanley, it was one of those questions that we began to ask some of the well-placed Falkland Islands, tell us, what do you know? Now, I was actually only there for about a week after the surrender anyway, but certainly my colleagues who were out down there later on said, you know, there was nothing that they could do, and there was nothing that the Foreign Office could do, and there was nothing that the Ministry of Defence could do. It was a surprise attack in many respects.
Sure, sure.
But I'm certain, I'm sure, the Foreign Office will have known something, but I think that's for the Foreign Office to answer, because I don't know, I certainly am not aware of anything.
Okay, I see. So earlier you mentioned learning about what had happened from your commanding officer. Can you talk about those first few hours and days as you were and your section were kind of mobilizing for what was to come?
Yes, we were based at what was called Stonehouse Barracks in Plymouth, which was the headquarters of the 3rd Commando Brigade. And I'd just gone for a run. The boss called me in, said, oh, this has happened. The Falklands have been taken over. And to be honest about it, I said, well, where the heck is the Falkland Islands? It was almost a joke. But he said, yes, you're quite right. And he got a map out and said, this is where we are. And then way down the end of the map, he said, this is the Falkland Islands. And to some extent, it was the first time that it had, ever been mentioned to me, because I had no interest in it. My interest was the commander of brigade whenever we went to Norway, which was in the wintertime. In fact, I'd just come back from 5 weeks in Norway in any event. And so it was, you know, it was a bit of a mystery to me. And so I had a big, steep learning curve. None of my section had been down there. And so it was, you know, it was really quite new and a little bit of a surprise. But I was able to get a shower. That was the main thing.
That's good. Always good. So I understand from reading your book, I was shocked at the immediate need to go to like open source, publicly available materials to start to kind of build the picture of the Argentinian military capabilities and the overall situation. Can you talk about the sources that you were using to kind of build those first reports?
Up in Plymouth, there was a very reasonable library. And we simply went to the library, looked in the military history section. I think I went up with a couple of the guys. And we just trawled through some of the books and volumes and things like that. I had a word with the librarian and said, if we need some of these books, would you mind if we came back and maybe did some copying? But it's a fundamental thing of intelligence. You get your intelligence from wherever you can. It doesn't always have to come out of top secret documents. It comes from anywhere. And that had been my culture, the culture of the Intelligence Corps for a long time. You don't always get everything from secrets. You get it from publications.
Mm-hmm.
Quite apart from talking to people. We did put out a thing on the local radio. If there's anybody who was maybe wanted to have a conversation with us or who were down in the Falkland Islands. Interestingly enough, we only got a couple of calls. of people who were able to provide us with a little bit of information, but we knew quite from quite earlier on that we were going to have to start from a blank piece of paper.
I see. Yeah, that seems like a daunting task, although I know that you guys did a heck of a job of putting everything together before things really heated up, so to speak.
Yes. I mean, it's what you have to do to some extent is you filter out the stuff that you want or you want, and then you get rid of the rest of it. And so you begin quite quickly to focus on exactly what the what's going to happen. I was aware from the because I'd been to the very first briefing by the brigade commander Julian Thompson, and he said, right, this is what we've got to do, and this is how we're going to do it. And I have a highly rated Brigadier Thompson, trusted him implicitly that he was going to make it to the right information. We therefore briefed the intelligence section. We gave them various tasks to do. Think about the mapping we're probably going to need. Another one, we're thinking about what equipment do we need to take with us. So it was just basically everything just sort of filtered into a logical solution in the knowledge we were going to be on board ships for a long time, but we didn't know when.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is, of course, we didn't know what ships we were going to go on either.
How quickly was the decision reached that you would be going there and retaking the islands by force? Like, was there any, you know, diplomatic negotiations or anything like that, or any chance that the UK would back down now that, you know, the Argentinian forces had occupied the islands? Or was it always going to be a fight?
It was always going to be a fight. Like yourselves, we aren't going to back down when we don't need to.
Mm-hmm.
And if we need to defend our logistics and resources, then we will do that. And I've got it down that the next thing that really happened was when South Georgia was captured, which was on the following day, which is on the 3rd of April. And that, to some extent, said that the Argentines are serious here about this encroaching. I'm going to use the word encroaching advisedly into parts of the South Atlantic, which we had, or the British rather, had been a key player. So it really was, to some extent, in the rugby connotation, that the Argentines had scored a try.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, we were going to have to deal with it. The UN, of course, as always, they don't sit on the fence, in my view. They condemned the Argentine invasion because it was the right thing to do. And that's why the task force was assembled the day after the Argentines invaded on the 3rd of April, that the British began to put together a task force.
Okay, I've got it. But that's still several weeks of sailing time after you leave port to get down there. So they had quite a bit of time to dig in and prepare for your arrival then, I take it.
Oh, yes. And we had time, of course, to prepare it. So it's the other side of the coin. We were not by any means doing nothing. So far as we were in on the intelligence side of life, it was a brand new piece of work. It was a brand new piece of paper, as I've said to you.
Mm-hmm.
That piece of paper needs to be filled. And we had a Royal Marine, my section. I was in the Royal Marine section, Commander Gobe intelligence section, all Royal Marines. And they did a brilliant job of just putting their heads down and helping us put something together that would enable us to land on the Falkland Islands. They did a first-class job.
Mm.
They weren't really experienced in collation and assembling the information. To some extent, it was up to me then to convince them to do, you know, who, what, why, when, where and how many. Those logical questions that we need about the enemy. And once we got on board the ships, we had nothing else to do, to be blunt about it, but run around the deck about a couple of times during the day, do all the collation and do all the stuff that we needed to do, and maybe go on the evening time and have a couple of beers. But then we began to, as part of the information that we began to collect, we were able to assemble things like intelligence summaries, some reports on equipment, and then everything essentially began to gather pace. It's a fairly logical sequence. You know, it's a bit like buying a house, isn't it? You do this. Once you've got on the road, then everything fits into place as you're building that house, and that's exactly what we did.
Mm-hmm.
And we moved three times, I think, on the trip down from a small office to a much bigger office, because that's what we needed for all our maps and 1 to 50,000 maps. Everything had to be thought through and dealt with. If there was a problem, we would deal with it there and then. Brigadier Thompson, regularly came into the intelligence section. I think a lot of it was morale, and that's what good leaders do. But also, he wanted our opinion, in addition to the opinions being given by his staff officers and one or two others on board the ship. Mm-hmm. So it was a very, very important period, frankly. We essentially, on the trip down to Ascension Island, which was essentially got ourselves together, knew we had to do a job. We knew what we had to do. We knew we were going to be short on lots of bits and bobs, but the Royal Marines being Royal Marines, it didn't make an ounce of difference. We must sort the problem out, and that's exactly what we did.
Sure, sure, understandable.
It was a pleasure.
That is amazing to me. That's kind of, I don't think that, you know, we've had a similar experience, the American forces, in a while, because you're sailing down there, you know exactly when you're going to arrive, and the fight's going to start, whether you're ready or not, by that point. So you have to be ready. You can't, you know, kick off at a time of your choosing, like we did with Desert Storm in 91 and that sort of thing. Like it's going to happen on the day that it's going to happen, no matter what.
I couldn't agree more with you. I think it was very, the comments you made about Desert Storm and so forth. I found it really quite interesting, quite worrying. I think probably because the Allies of not learning maybe the lessons that Operation Corporate, the recovery of the Falkland Islands showed us. Or things that can be done, bearing in mind, of course, we weren't being flown from A to B, and our distance was absolutely enormous, 8,000 miles.
Right.
And I think it's a team spirit, which was absolutely crucial. Things go wrong, of course, arguments happen, that's no wrong with it, nothing wrong with that at all. But in the end, it's making sure you're down the other end, that you've done what you set out to achieve. Mm-hmm. And I think it was. To me, it was a remarkable operation, frankly. I'm probably getting a bit way ahead, but I take your point completely, frankly. I do take your point completely about Desert Storm and one or two other operations when it has been far too slow and consequently maybe needless casualties. Mm-hmm.
Right, yeah, that's always a tragic possibility.
Yes.
So, Nick, I understand from your book that that British intelligence was able to intercept some telegrams going back and forth to Argentina from the islands, and those were of significant value. Can you talk about that a little bit?
I can talk a little bit about. I don't think it'd be right for me to discuss any great detail, but shall we say it is, how should we put this, that intercepting somebody else's telegrams and letters are not well known. Mm-hmm. It happens all the time.
Right.
And inevitably, and you can imagine what I'm essentially saying, but you can imagine that the situation which we were in, that we needed anything we get from any source. And I think it's probably best I say no more than that in case I commit a heinous crime.
Okay, sure thing. So reading between the lines, anyway.
Yeah, absolutely.
Nick, I've spoken to a number of British historians here in the past, and one thing that comes up again and again is that Official Secrets Act. And how incredibly stringent it is about so many things. And I don't know if that's really kind of guiding the conversation here like a third person, really, but that is, it's so difficult to pry anything out of British historical archives related to espionage, unfortunately. So,
yes.
We seem to declassify things a lot more quickly here in the US.
Yes, we are aware of it. And I'm aware of it as well. Having been, to put it bluntly, in that world for my military career, and indeed when I left the services, I'm fully aware of the need for secrecy and the need to deal with things when things go wrong. So, yes, but it's not to say that when those who need that information should have access to that information. Key to that is any operation, frankly.
Right, right. And this is clearly a situation where you need every available means for gathering essential information, you know, right before large-scale combat operations kick off. And so I'm glad that they were of value. That capability was used and provided some value anyway.
I think most modern-day military organizations will inevitably use that type of information. And indeed, if you think about it, the history of that information, it's been around since, the first time people were intercepting people signaling each other using flags. It's not exactly new. Mm-hmm. How it's done is sometimes the thing that is new.
Right, right, exactly.
And I think what I'm saying to some extent is, yes, the flags happen, but how that information is acquired is something that is where it goes a little bit more, well, it doesn't go a little bit more, it is rightly discreet, shall we say.
Certainly.
Indeed, as happens in commercial organizations. You know, you think of some of the broadcasting organizations, they will have their secrets, as will every company in the country does. Mm-hmm. Every country in the world does.
So, Nick, I want to, in a sense, jump ahead to the end really briefly here. The whole time that you're preparing for this, you're building this picture of capabilities and forces that are there on the island and that can be used against you. By the time the conflict was over, in hindsight, how accurate was that picture that you built? Was there anything like, were there any major surprises waiting for you by the time you arrived, for example?
I think the answer to your question is no. We knew from very early on, by the time we landed, should I say, that we had a very, very good idea of who the opposition were from a number of sources, quite apart from the things we've just been discussing, that we had 12,000 prisoners
who
had been captured. So the interrogation, for instance, was, you know, was a big, big issue. And of course, interrogation, by definition, to some extent, is always very sensitive anyway. But the factor is, prisoners get captured and people talk. Mm-hmm. So when you're presented with 12,000 of them, you get a bit of a sort of birthday cake. But being taken prisoner is not nice. It really isn't, because you have no idea what's happening, what's going to happen to you. But our view was, we got some conscripts who are very frightened. They are fearful. They're probably scared of their officers. They have no idea what it's like to be taken prisoner. And therefore, one chats with them, and what therefore gets information. Mm-hmm. That information there comes into our headquarters, so that we're able to fight the battle. But I think the 12,000 prisoners, I mean, it's an astonishing number if you think about it, who surrendered quickly to a force of 7,000 or 8,000, mm-hmm, who had just traveled 8,000 miles.
Right. I mean, that seems like a tremendous logistical challenge to adequately care for that many hungry mouths to feed, so to speak, you know, people that have to be sheltered, fed and watered in some way, and potentially, you know, need some medical care due to wounds suffered or whatever have you. And that seems like an enormous burden to take on. So were the British forces adequately prepared for that?
Absolutely. The logistic people were prepared for it. Once, you know, bear in mind that the task force itself, there was two or three elements. The primary task force in which I was in landed 4,000 of us against 12,000 Argentines. Hmm. And by the end of the campaign, the British forces had doubled that, if not more. But these are professional soldiers and sailors and airmen who knew warfare and were able to do the right thing, one of which is you simply don't break the Geneva Conventions. And there is absolutely no reason at all why you shouldn't be decent to people who've been taken prisoner. No reason at all. And it is that sort of attitude that most certainly helped us. You don't have to shoot people. You can take people prisoner, and provided that you turn it to Geneva Conventions. Indeed, we had Geneva Conventions people down there in any event. It is the right thing to do, that you use the skills that you have in order to ensure that the enemy are treated in a proper way. Of course, the upside of that is, if you treat them nicely, they'll treat you nicely when we want information from them.
Right, right, absolutely. And actually, Nick, that brings up another point. I didn't read anything in your book and the little bit else that I've read about the conflict, but the Argentinians were not ignoring Geneva Conventions or anything either. I mean, they were not brutalizing or mistreating the residents, the island residents, anything like that at that time, were they? They were relative, in terms of being an occupying force anyway, they were relatively like respectful of the people and the economy and the community at large?
That is absolutely correct. It was quite astonishing as we advanced from San Carlos, where we landed. There were a couple of times when I can remember one lady, I can't remember where it was now, but we'd walk into this settlement. And she said to me, oh, you will treat the Argentines properly, won't you? Well, of course we will. But you're quite right. I mean, they behaved, and all credit, to be honest about it, to their officers, who some of whom can be pretty brutal, and indeed the senior ranks, the sergeant majors and so on and so forth. They knew it was not the right thing to do to commit offences as they do in their own country against the Falkland Islanders, because it'll get worse, because that's when things get mean. and things get nasty. You know, that's a fact of war, frankly. Mm-hmm. But you're quite right. The Argentines behaved reasonably, to be honest about it, according to their codes of honour. But certainly some of the officers, you began to wonder about their attitude. Just one or two of them.
I see. I see. Yeah, I think that's normal, not understandable or reasonable, but certainly normal in a conflict. I think that at least a fraction would be that way. Before we go on, I want to tell you all about a new podcast from Tenderfoot TV called To Die For. Imagine you were a fly on the wall at a dinner between the Mafia, the CIA, and the KGB. That's where this unprecedented podcast begins. Brought to you by the makers of the hit podcast To Live and Die in L.A., To Die For marks the first time a Russian-trained honey trap has told her story from beginning to end. Taught to seduce men for their secrets, and sometimes their lives, Alia Rosa was trained to believe that her body no longer belonged to her. It belonged to the state. She was meticulously trained to be the perfect weapon, able to seduce her targets into compromising situations that have ended careers, and sometimes lives. From Tenderfoot TV, the studio that brought you Up and Vanished, and To Live and Die in L.A. Make sure you check out To Die For, available beginning on March 26th, wherever you get your podcasts.
Absolutely, yeah.
So once you arrived, Nick, what was D-Day like for you personally, actually making landfall after all those weeks of preparation?
Totally unexpected.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. We had no idea. Honestly, we steamed into San Carlos. I remember it was quite a clear day, my recollection. And we were sort of ambling around the decks, as one does. And then all of a sudden, these aircraft screamed over the head. I said, who are they? What are they doing here? And that's when the air raids kicked in. Then we were then forced to do something that very few of us had any experience at all, if any, which was to be under air attack. Hmm. I think it was the noise. It was the noise. It was the gunfire. It did take a little bit of getting used to, but it was just a shock, the initial shock of what was going on. And then once you got used to it, you could all, I'm not going to say you'd be a little bit casual about it, but that's not the right thing to say. But we got used to it, shall we say. Mm-hmm. But it wasn't, certainly was, and particularly when the ships began, you know, one, two ships began to sink or were damaged. This didn't happen to the Royal Navy. This is not the way we've done it since 1945. And all of a sudden, we were fighting a war where the Navy were having to fight a war which they hadn't really thought about for some time, which was air defense against modern aircraft, or reasonably modern aircraft anyway. It was a bit of a shock, certainly on the first day, I think we had about six air raids that day, I think. So somebody would have to tell me. And inside the ship, the klaxons went. Everybody did do was dive under the table, and then we sort of sheepishly said, why have we dived under the table on the ship, which is, I've got iron decks. You know, it was one of those. And I'm not going to say we got used to it, but it became much easier to manage. When you're on a ship, you're going to be relatively covered, and this one's hit. But on the ground, when you're in a trench or something like that, it's an altogether different. I think I was in about four or five air raids whilst I was on the ground, and that is an altogether different experience in any way.
Oh, wow. Can't imagine.
Because there is absolutely no cover except for your trench.
Mm-hmm. I've seen some of the film footage of the Argentinian aircraft right there, in the Sound. It's some of the most incredible war footage that I've ever seen, personally. It must have been just unforgettable to be there that day. I've seen, you know, the anti-aircraft fire everywhere, the gouts of water going up, and they're low and fast coming in, and it must just incredibly intense, even watching it on a screen decades later. So I can't imagine what it was like to be there that day.
It was intense, there's no doubt about it. But to admit, to some extent, certainly on the ship, I was on HMS Fearless, and it was a really good ship. And we trusted the Royal Navy to do what they were good at, which is defend their ships. And to some extent, once we got used to the air raids, and it's all to some extent, it became, we can deal with this. We'll have a couple of minutes finding some cover. Then we've got to get on with our jobs or whatever we're going to be doing. But yes, it was very dramatic. Mm-hmm. It was unexpected and nothing like the war films. that's what we had. You know, in our lives, we've watched war films, and this was something else. Ooh, and I think the courage of the Argentine pilots was astonishing. It really was. Well, I found it in any way. you almost have to want to shake their hands and say, you crack on, Dad, you've done a good job. And it was astonishing. I mean, I did meet a number of Argentine prisoners who had been shot down.
Oh, wow.
And that was an altogether different experience because they'd just been through a horrendous experience, which has been mm-hmm. shot down by enemy fire. They'd been captured, so far as they were concerned, anyway.
I do remember an anecdote from your book, and I don't remember the pilot's name, but you wrote about one pilot he was on just sort of a reconnaissance patrol, and he by himself came up on the entire fleet unexpectedly and somehow survived. And it was clear the way that you wrote it, the admiration you had for that guy and his skills that saved his own life, even if he was the declared enemy during the conflict.
Yes, I mean, war is a very strange game. It's not all blood and guts. You know, things happen. You admire the enemy for the courage that those enemy pilots came down. I mean, I was caught on Manharrit just before we got into Stanley the night before. We got nobbled by seven of these Skyhawks, and they came in really low. And by low, I mean 200 feet or 150 feet like that. And we often wonder, you know, why so low? And we never really got to the bottom of it. But they certainly brassed us up when their machine guns opened up and the bombs dropped and so on and so forth. And I think they were probably as determined to make a mess of us as we were trying to avoid it. It was odd, really, when you're looking back, that to admire the courage of the pilots at the same time as they're throwing bombs at us.
Right.
You know, and they caused a lot of damage. They sank a couple of ships, and they caused casualties. Mm-hmm. There was no great hatred about them at all. And I don't really know the reason for that. I can't really explain it. I can only imagine there had been historically a reasonable relationship between England, or Great Britain, should I say, and Argentina. Mm-hmm. But quite why not? I'm not quite sure why.
Yeah, it's surprising, but it's kind of gratifying to hear that you can still have that admiration and still be doing your best to, you know, overcome your adversary no matter what.
Oh, yes. And that's what soldiering is all about, or being in the armed forces is all about. I mean, we were very much aware of the Geneva Conventions, for instance, whereas I think some Argentines were not that very much aware of the Geneva Conventions. And therefore, when we took the prisoners, we treated them properly and made sure that they were fed and wounded and so on and so forth. But at the same time, they knew they were going to, well, some of them were going to be interrogated by ourselves, and rightly so. And I often think, I've often wondered, is because both countries played rugby. You know rugby? Do the English sport rugby?
I'm familiar with it, but I haven't really watched. I don't know the rules or the ins and outs of it or anything.
It's a slightly more, how should we say, it's gentle game than American football. Well, the odd game I play with that is horrendous. But I think there was this element, you know, it was Great Britain that they were fighting against the British, and the British were apparently well known to be decent people, apparently. Mm-hmm. And that was certainly told to me on a couple of occasions. We didn't mind fighting the British because we knew we would not get shot.
I see. That's good to know. So since you've mentioned prisoner interrogations, did that become one of your primary duties once you actually were on the ground, or were you still advising the commander on the, you know, overall intelligence picture or something like that?
Well, I was in the intelligence section, so the section advised the brigade commander. But I was the only intelligence interrogator in Brigade HQ. And therefore, I couldn't speak Spanish, frankly. Well, not a lot of Spanish anyway. But I managed to find a couple of guys who spoke Spanish. In fact, one was a Spaniard and then another was a South American. And I enlisted their help. And they said, yeah, no problem at all. And therefore, we were able to go and talk to people who'd just been shot down or had just come to a battle, who were shocked by being captured, the shock of the battle. And we were able to go along and use the shock of capture, the idea that you are entitled to interrogate prisoners, but you have to conform to Geneva Conventions. And there are certain cultures that demands. Mm-hmm. And I think once they began to know that we weren't going to put them up against war and shoot them or something like that, which they'd obviously done to their own countrymen in quite a few times, that was going to be to our advantage whenever we talked to prisoners of war. But prisoners of war probably are the most exposed people on the battlefield. I mean, if you can imagine being captured by people who don't speak their language, you've got no idea what's going to happen to you over the next day, weeks, and maybe months, and possibly years. You're certainly not going to see your family, and yet you have to survive. And we exploited that, and quite happily to do so. There were some occasions when I needed an interpreter, particularly when I was dealing with some of the prisoners of war, and maybe it's a bit of a ruckus, and I'd find a sergeant major, generally a sergeant major, and say, can you please help me with this? And they're happy to say, yes, yeah, no problem, si, senor, and off we go and deal with the issue.
Mm-hmm.
It's an aspect of war which people love to talk about, but we were very certain in our own mind that we must conform to the Geneva Conventions, because that was the right thing to do. There were actually people from the Red Cross on the battlefield. They were quite happy to, we were more than happy, in fact, they were allowed to come and see what we were doing wherever we held prisoners of war.
Hmm.
And that included for those who had been wounded on the battlefield or in our military hospitals, to the interrogation centres and one of the other things that went on.
Hmm. I'm very curious, Nick, how did that work anyway? Are they just kind of standing nearby and keeping an eye on you, or are they trying to, I don't know if I'd say interfere, but like intrude in any way? Like, are they an earshot of interrogation?
Not at all. They know it is a fact of life. Interrogation has been part of military history for centuries and has been misused and has been used. And they were very, certainly when we were repatriating the prisoners of war from Stanley, when the Argentines were being get rid of, the one or two tricks that some of the officers convinced the conscripts to do, like hiding and not wearing the right uniform and all this sort of thing, they would often put that, the Red Cross would often say, no, si, senor, you can't do that, senor. And then they go away and see the most senior officer and say to him, that cannot only happen.
Mm-hmm.
I accompanied quite often the Red Cross, so I knew what they were doing so that I could report back of what, how the whole, that was in the repatriation, how the prisons were being dealt with and were being dealt with properly.
Okay, I see. I've seen a photo of you, Nick, interrogating one of the pilots. I think it's in the archives of the Imperial War Museum. And it looks just like two guys along with the interpreter just having a chat right there on a couple of chairs. And it looked like a barn or something like that, it looked like.
Yes, he'd been shot down. I think it was Garcia, Lieutenant Garcia. He had been shot down at the Battle of Goose Green. So he was brought to us. We were by still that time at San Carlos. And he was one of a number of people who'd been picked up over the next previous few days. And that is what interrogation is all about. It's a classic case of good interrogation, to be frank about it. Obviously, I was in a chair, my recollection, or maybe on a seat of some sort. I think he was on the ground. And that is just part of the psychological thing which you expect to do, which you use as part of the psychology. I'm the boss, you're down there. And he was perfectly all right, Garcia. I mean, we had a chat with him, and that was quite sufficient. No problem at all.
Hmm. Was it common among all the prisoners that you interrogated, or the others did as well, was it common for them to just try to shut up and just say, you know, name, rank, and serial number, or something like that, or were they generally more talkative naturally?
I think being captured is not pleasant by mm-hmm. any means. It is most unpleasant. You're not going to see your friends, family, country perhaps, for quite a long time. The future may well be bleak or appear to be bleak. And therefore, you use that to your advantage. Did they expect it? I just don't know. I expect they probably didn't, because their interrogation is very different from the way we would have handled it.
Mm-hmm.
Or we did handle it.
Sure. Did you find that you got a lot of like actionable information out of these interrogations? I mean, people that were just with their unit perhaps the day before or earlier in the day,
yes.
Were they giving you like immediately useful stuff?
Yes, very much so. You would expect to get that. You know, prisoners are part of the battlefield. And the idea that prisoners resist, certainly prisoners do resist. Now, there's no doubt about that. So you get rid of them and you talk to those who are more than happy to have a chat. And that's it. That's the way it is. You know, this is not a sort of cowboy, not a sort of war film where people are being thrashed all over the time. It is a time when humanity, to put it bluntly, kicks in. In my view, what's the point of beating somebody up and hurting him when perhaps the person next door is more than happy to talk?
Yeah, that's an excellent point. When you have a number of prisoners to choose from, you don't need to spend hours trying to break one really tough guy. If the next guy in, we'll start talking in the first 2 minutes, I suppose.
That's absolutely correct. There were occasions, I must admit, when we got on special forces, who by definition do have a completely different culture.
Mm-hmm.
But I come back to the point I've just made. They have just been captured. and the future is bleak. Is it worth resisting? And the prisoner has to ask himself, if it is resisting, what is it going to cost me? It really is quite a sort of, it's a very simple equation, really. And equally, that the people who are interrogating also need to have exactly the same culture, if that's the right philosophy, because they are also after information which may be critical. So it is a bit of a game. It's not the mm-hmm. right word. I can say, I mean, the game's probably not the right word. It is a feature of the battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
Except that people don't get killed. But people may well get very distressed, maybe for quite long times, and maybe for the rest of their lives. Perhaps.
Yeah, I have to assume that those hours or days of capture are some of the most unforgettable and potentially life-changing that they'll ever have.
I couldn't agree more. Wish I'd been able to contact. In fact, I do have an Argentine colleague of mine. We're in regular contact. Who in between us, he's a professor of history, and we do discuss the different cultures. And he has told me that one or two people have never really recovered from being captured in the first place. Quite apart from having a chat with an interrogator.
Really. Wow.
Yeah.
So, as I recall, and once again, you know, just skipping ahead a little bit, by the time the fighting was over with, repatriation happened pretty quickly for those guys, right? Like, you were ready to offload those prisoners as soon as the fighting was done and the islands were retaken, if I recall correctly.
Yes. Once the fighting was over, as you correctly say, the Argentines had been penned into, essentially, to Stanley. So we had one major issue was the population of Stanley, who obviously going to need to be looked after by our people. And also, what is the point of keeping these people on this tiny island? And there's 12,000 of them, and we don't necessarily have the food to feed them.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, in many respects, in my view, it was a humane act to do. And I think it therefore set the seal to say to them, right, we've just played a game of rugby, the British have won, it's about time, let's go and have a beer, type of thing, if you see what I mean. So it was the right thing to do, and there was no point in keeping those men. Most, in fact, all of them had been disarmed, that's number one. And secondly, they were, without doubt, will have felt rather unhappy about being put in their position by the Argentine government. Most of the conscripts were just, they just wanted to go home.
Sure. It was never really there. For some of them, at least, I'm sure it was never really their fight to begin with. They were just being forced to go.
That is correct. But that's the national service. That's, you know, that is common throughout the world.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes think governments don't necessarily, certainly my experience, maybe, don't look at the downside of people who've been taken prisoner of war.
Right. So, Nick, for the duration of the fighting, was it a very dynamic situation for you? Like, were you sleeping in a different place every night and constantly on the move, or were you mostly set up, you know, near where you had landed, for example, having prisoners brought to you, or some mixture of the two?
Certainly San Carlos, we had a prison camp there, a prison cage, shall we say, where me and my team stayed. And yes, we did sleep under cover, and it was a pigsty.
Oh,
that's where
wow.
we slept.
Oh wow.
So we were undercover. Some of the prisoners, just to make it worse for them, were left out in the cold and the rain. But again, that is the nature. And provided that we didn't break the law of Geneva Conventions, and we were happy. I think I got about two or three days, maybe at San Carlos. But I was left at San Carlos for some time after the Battle of Goose Green to deal with the prisoners who had been captured at the Battle of Goose Green, because we needed information from them of the Argentine position, the areas that we couldn't see, which was in Stanley and one or two other places. And so I stayed there, I think my recollection about maybe 3 days, maybe four, before I was then moved up to Teal Inlet, where I rejoined the brigade headquarters. They essentially stayed with the brigade HQ for the rest of the operation.
Okay, I see. And because of this, like we said, you know, a large scale conflict, were you having to like type up or handwrite a lot of reporting, or were you doing a lot of fast verbal updates within the command group area or some mixture?
Most of it, we tried to keep it verbal. Took good reasons for that, not the least of which was not writing anything paper that the enemy could use.
Sure, sure.
Because we'd managed to get a lot of stuff from the Argentines, which they had left behind. But it was very much, how should we say, I think it was trust that those of us who were involved in interrogation, and basically it was only me and one other, we were giving them the right information that they wanted. And if they said, could you get this from a prisoner, then we'd try and do it. It wasn't always possible by any means, because some people resisted. But we didn't necessarily have the time to deal with somebody who was resisting. We wanted mm-hmm. people who were prepared to have a chat with us. It's hard work. Yeah, it was. It's hard work. But it was expected because, you know, we were in fighting a war, and there's a lot of sleepless nights, and maybe sleeping during the day for a couple of hours or so, and then moving on to where we were going to go. And so when the Brigade HQ, and I moved again with the Brigade HQ when we lost, at Teal, and then we began to move towards Stanley from Teal and places like Mount Harriet and so on and so forth, then that's when it became quite hectic because there's a lot going on there. We had three operations and a lot of prisoners of war and a lot of business from the logistics side of life who had to deal with the logistics of thousands of prisoners of war. And here's the thing, you know, we haven't really talked about this. How on earth do you deal with 4,000 prisoners who suddenly end up on your doorstep? Again, the commander of the brigade had a good organization, had the ability to do it, and the willingness to deal with the issue.
Mm-hmm.
And we certainly didn't want UK to be seen by the Swiss authorities or the Red Cross to be seen to be not doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I see. Was there ever a major concern that they, I mean, like you've got so many and you're spread so thin that they would potentially try a mass escape or resist or something like that? Even, you know, 4,000 unarmed guys can still cause a lot of trouble.
Yes, but a small percentage, that'll be a small percentage. The most, like most of the Argentines, wanted to go home.
Right.
They had just been on national service or they'd just been on the draft, had a pretty tough time in the Falklands before we arrived because of the weather and one or two other bibs and bobs.
Oh, wow.
I think maybe three or four of the regiments, including Marines, had just fought a battle, and they'd had enough. Some, I have to say, their special forces tried to tough it out. Their Marines tried to be tough with our Marines, which was probably not the right thing to do. But certainly some of the special forces who tried to stir trouble, we dealt with it quite quickly, quite often dealing with, not ourselves necessarily, but using some of our more tougher people in our units to say, right, can you deal with this?
Mm-hmm.
And the Marines and the paras would go away and help us deal with it, and then everything would be then all fine.
Okay.
We did not have what you might expect, any sort of mutiny or riot from any of the prisoners of war, which is truly astonishing if you think of the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
But there again, their morale had gone down. The ships were out in the harbour. Oh, and that ship's about to take me home. Oh, I think I'll happily do whatever the British want me to do.
Sure, sure. Understandable.
But we did retain 500 or so who were selected because they offered information or had information. And that we kept them, or the British government kept them, until such time as Argentina accepted a full surrender, which is what they did, which is what they eventually did. I think it was about 3 weeks later. By that time, I was on my way back to England.
Oh, wow.
Oh, yes. I mean, when I left after the Falklands, about a week, when the brigade left, went back to UK, colleagues of mine were arriving, which had then allowed me to go home.
Okay, I see. Fighting had completely ended by the time you left, is that correct?
Yes. It had left a week before. The Argentines had surrendered. They had lost the four battles, I think it was, the four battles of the last part of the war. And essentially, a surrender had been agreed, which then allowed us not to have to take responsibility for the prisoners of war, and indeed our logistics people, our logistics staff, who don't have to look after those prisoners of war, but we can happily send them back to their home, to friends and family.
Okay. I have to imagine by the time your time on the ground was over with, you were like physically and mentally exhausted.
I was slightly worried about the word mentally, frankly. I no doubt I was exhausted. I was tired. No, I'm going to use the word I was tired. There's no doubt about that. But against that, any mental strains that you mentioned were certainly removed when we began to steam on the course set for UK.
Oh, I bet, yeah, I bet that was incredible.
Well, yes, it was. It was in the Canberra, which was one of our liners, and they are absolutely superb. They looked after us. Absolutely brilliant.
Okay, so yeah, a passenger liner then.
Passenger liner in the fleet of ships that the country has. It's taken 3,000 or 4,000 of the soldiers down south anyway. So they were part of our group. They were just unbelievable. I'm not going to say we misbehaved and all the rest of it, but they looked after us superbly. Really did.
I'll bet.
And they made sure that we put some weight back on that we'd lost, and so on. Yeah.
That must have been a great way to end the campaign there, that long, somewhat luxurious trip back.
And also the terrific welcoming for our families.
Oh, I'll bet.
We arrived in Portsmouth, and it was totally unexpected. And there was my wife on the dock, and friends and families, and we just filed off the ship, and it was just like something that hadn't been seen for decades, troops coming back from a war like that.
Yeah, I understand that this was tremendously just energizing for the populace as a whole, this victory.
It certainly was. My recollection was, have I just done 2 years in Northern Ireland? Yes, I think I'd just done 2 years in Northern Ireland before I went to the Commando Brigade, and therefore this set the ceiling on it, if that's the right thing.
Mm-hmm.
We'd won an astonishing victory, frankly. Historically, it was truly astonishing, and Britain could then have held its head high again under some very difficult economic circumstances at the time. And therefore, these 6,000 soldiers who went down south were able to contribute to remoralizing the country.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it was important. I still do. It was an important issue that we were able to do. It was well worth it, and it was the right thing to do.
Yeah, it sounds like an unforgettable experience, certainly.
It was an unforgettable experience, and that's one of the reasons that I wrote some of those books. Indeed, talking to you, I have to say, I hadn't been asked by anybody else for a long time, and I'm delighted to do it.
Oh, really?
Wow. It's one of those probably things that's still talked about in the UK, the Falklands campaign, the Falklands War. And even when we play soccer against them and rugby against them, there's all the chants come out. And when our teams go over to Argentina, it's all very decent. Right? There was no hostility. There was no enmity about it at all. Absolutely none.
It's good. So do they still maintain any sort of claim on the islands? Do they still say that they're rightfully Argentinian? Is there a chance that this could flare up again in some way?
I don't think so, personally. Logically, strategically, they could do it again. There's no doubt about that, because of the distance between UK and the war and the South Atlantic. But I honestly think that war is one of those things, if you lose it, then we'd rather not repeat it.
Right.
Sort of thing. And I have met Argentines before over the years, and there's never been any animosity about it at all, which I think is a very good thing in today. I think it's always been a good thing in any event.
Mm-hmm.
I think maybe it's maybe a little bit too awkward in this day and age to demand that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But it was a thing. I'm going to use the word friendship for the sake of another word. But there was no atrocities that you see around in today's combat zones at all. And that the civilians are treated in the proper that they should be doing, and prisoners of war are looked after as opposed to being in horrible places.
Mm-hmm. That was my impression. And I wanted to, kind of get your thoughts on that. Well, but compared to so many other conflicts, it seemed like a very, very clean fight on both sides. And, I kind of hate to say that, knowing that, so many lives were lost and property destroyed and ships sunk and that sort of thing. But there's not like the stain of atrocity marking that war, as far as I can tell. Is there anything that came up during that time that, the Argentinians had to answer for afterwards or anything like that?
Not as far as I'm aware. Certainly nothing that I've heard. And there was no hunting parties, intelligence people like myself, mm-hmm. hunting out people or anything like that at all. There was none of that. I think that the Argentines knew they'd been beaten well, and somebody was going to take them home. I suspect there were probably amongst some of the more militant units, maybe some of the Argentine commandos and special forces, who would have rather had a different outcome.
Hmm.
But they were in no position, frankly, to even think about that. If you think on our side, there was a complete brigade of experienced commandos and two parachute regiments who have a good reputation. Quite apart from the fact, we teach our soldiers, frankly, to fight fairly, if that's the right word. I can't think of another word. But don't break the rules. War is going to be nasty in any event, but why make it worse?
Right, exactly.
And the civilians themselves, I think, were very grateful that there hadn't been any atrocities or any awkward atrocities, as far as I was aware, not as far as I'm aware, should I say. And there were certainly occasions when the Falkland Islanders would come along and offer water and some of the very limited that they food had to some of the prisoners of war.
Hmm. That's a little bit surprising. They were taking care of the occupying forces a little bit after they were bested.
Yes, I think it was the relationship to some extent between the British and Argentina to some extent, diametrically opposed in many, many respects, not only from the religion, but also from the politics.
Mm-hmm.
But I think probably the British had a reasonable reputation, even as colonists, which is probably a horrible thing to say, but it did seem to work.
Really is an amazing story, Nick. What an amazing conflict that was in so many ways.
Yes, it was. It was. I mean, I'm glad I took part in it. I'm glad I came at the other end quite happy. And it's just great to have been into an extraordinary campaign, which should never have happened, frankly.
Mm-hmm.
You know, 8,000 miles away in the South Atlantic. It's just bizarre.
I know. It seems like so much more could have gone wrong than did go wrong. It could have gone very differently for a lot of different reasons, it seems like.
I think the commander control of the task force was exceptional. Some of the senior commanders were, in fact, almost all the commanders thought about everything and humane people. I can't comment about the Argentines because I know there was one or two huge silly incidents by some of the more, let's call them special forces maybe, that were unnecessary and didn't actually do Argentina's the reputation of Argentina any good at all. But if you come from a country where, you know, you use your special forces in a particular sort of way, then it's going to happen. But when you bring it to a country, a small island, where it is most unusual, there's inevitably going to be some form of a reaction against them.
Mm-hmm. Wow. So, Nick, I recall we were talking earlier, and you mentioned that Brigadier Thompson, who you mentioned briefly, he had some very, very positive things to say about the intelligence contribution after the fight was over in his official report. Is that right?
That's correct. Yes, he wrote this report and basically said, as the brigade commander, what impressed me most was the quality of intelligence assessments that were produced from quite early on and right through the campaign by the intelligence staffs in my superior headquarters, which is his own headquarters, and his own headquarters. And that by superior, he means another headquarters where there were other intelligence staff. The pièce de résistance was the identification of positions occupied by the Argentine regiment before we landed, which had proved amazingly accurate. I also felt that the way the intelligence staffs in theatre of operations coped with the interrogation of prisoners of war and was a mammoth task, which one considers the numbers that were taken and the short term of available, which was a week, to process them was a model of efficiency and humanity. The response by the members of the intelligence corps was positive and professional. And what he's essentially saying, as I'm sure you realize, that, you know, without a good, well-organized intelligence system, you're not going to win a battle.
Yeah, it sounds like the work that you did was absolutely instrumental in so many ways to guiding the decisions that were made throughout the campaign.
Yes, it was. And bearing in mind that the decisions, we will make an analysis. The intelligence staff will make an analysis, and the people who make that decision is the commander, because it is the commander who's going to lose or win the battle. Julian Thompson was a really good man to work for, and he was very happy to listen to the most junior of our soldiers in the intelligence corps, and indeed those in the intelligence arena, because of his interest and the confidence that he gives. I've been pretty regular to contact him anyway, because he loves to ask me about something even today. What did you know about that? Or what did I know about that? And I can say, well, I think this happened, the other. And he was a very good man, frankly. Yes, he was, well, a terrific guy.
Liked Fantastic. Him a lot. That's so good to hear. Well, looks like he held you in high regard as well, which is nice to hear, I'm sure.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Well, Nick, this has been an amazing discussion. I really appreciate your time here, and I'm very, very glad for the opportunity to learn more about that conflict, which interests a lot of people here in the U.S. as well as in U.K., of course. I'm curious, are you working on another book now? You're a very prolific writer, it seems.
No, I ran into a medical problem last year, and I felt it was probably that I was stopped writing a book now. But my wife has said to me, bless her, has said, yes, I should keep going because you know what to do and how to do it. But I'm not sure about the subjects at the moment, because I'm not too sure about the conflicts since, because they're very international, whereas the Falklands is a very national war. I mean, it took me quite a lot, doing this wonderful thing, this interview with you. It's taken me about a week or so to set everything out.
Oh, really?
Oh, absolutely right, yes. So that you had the right information, and I possibly had the right answers.
Wow.
Okay. I don't know.
Nick, that's so funny to me. And, I sometimes have the authors that I interview at a bit of a disadvantage, because even if they lived it, or if they, spent several years researching a topic, I read about it a week or two ago, and they may have written the book 3 or 5 or 10 years ago. And they're kind of having to dredge it up, as you mentioned right now. So sometimes it is a little bit of a challenge for some of my author guests to be fully prepared in the same way that I am, because, it was just a day or two ago that it was all fresh in my mind.
Absolutely. No, I couldn't agree more.
Well, yeah, I really appreciate your time. Like I said, Nick, do you have a website or social media pages or anything you can share in case the listeners want to contact you?
All I've got is my email address. I've rather avoided, frankly, for good reason, for putting myself out too much to the social media world, frankly. I probably run into trouble, but my dear wife, great wife, she's deep into it. But it's really only my email address is what I normally use, I'm sorry to say.
Okay. Well, they can certainly find your books anyway, just like I did. They're on Amazon and a number of other sites as well. For anybody who wants to read this, the book is My Friends, the Enemy by Nick Vanderbilt. We'll share a link to that in the show notes of this episode and look him up as well. But like I said, you've written almost 24 at this point, so there are quite a few topics to choose from for anybody who's interested in British military history. So, Nick, thanks again for your time. I really appreciate it. And like you said, that it's also funny to me that you have such a deliberately low profile. That's very common, because often the people that I most want to talk to here are the most difficult to locate. So it's an ongoing challenge I face, I promise.
That's okay. Well, it's been an absolute pleasure to help you, I must admit. If there's anything I can do in the future, then just let me know.
Yeah, certainly. We'll stay in touch, and I've got a lot more of your books to read as well in the future.
That's my pleasure. And I'll tell my daughter off to get me on all these websites and things like that.
Okay, great. Well, thank you so much, Nick. You take care.
My pleasure. Bye then.
If you're interested in more of Spycraft 101, look for my page on Instagram at Spycraft101. You can also find more great articles on my website, spycraft101.com. Thank you all for listening, and I hope you'll stick around, because there is lots more to come.
Disclaimer. This podcast is for entertainment purposes only. The stories and statements expressed herein are experiences and opinions. They may not reflect the views of the host or the production studio. It's okay if you disagree with our content. No piece of media is right for everyone. If you love Spycraft 101, please check us out online, on Instagram, on YouTube, and especially on Patreon. Thank you for listening.